letter would reach Charleston, of course. Mother, Thomas, the entire family would read it with outrage and disgrace. She would never go home again. I wondered if she'd thought of that, how those words slammed shut whatever door was left there. Just then, Israel spoke from the back of the room, and I closed my eyes at the gentleness in his voice, the sudden kindness. You are both our sisters. We love you as Christ loves you. We've come here only to bring you back into good standing with your Quaker brethren. You may still return to us in full repentance, as the prodigal son returned to his father. You must recant the letter or be expelled, Mr. Betterman said, terse and plain. Expelled. The word hung like a small blade, almost visible in the brightness. This could not happen. I'd spent 13 years with the Quakers, 6 pursuing the ministry, the only profession left to me. I'd given up everything for it. Marriage, Israel, children. I hastened to speak before Nina. I knew what she would say, and then the blade would fall. Please, I know you're a merciful people.
Try and understand, Sarah. We looked the other way while you sat on the Negro pew, Catherine said. But it's gone too far now.
She laced her fingers beneath her chin, and her knuckles shone white. And you have to consider, too, where you'll go if you don't recant. I care for you both, but naturally, you couldn't stay here. Panic arched into my throat. Is it so wrong to write a letter? Is it so wrong to put feet to our prayers?
Matters like this, they aren't the work of a woman's life, Israel said, stepping from the shadowed place along the wall. Surely you're not blind to that.
His voice was mired in hurt and frustration, the same tone he'd had when I turned down his proposal, and I knew he was speaking about more than the letter.
We have no choice. What you've done by declaring yourself in this manner is outside the bounds of Quakerism.
I reached for Nina's hand. It felt clammy and hot. I looked at Israel. Only Israel.
We cannot recant the letter.
I only wish I'd signed it too.
Nina's hand tightened on mine, squeezing to the point of pain.
Handful. 4th of August. Dear Sarah, Mama passed on last month. She fell into a sleep under the oak tree and never roused. She stayed asleep 6 days before she died in her bed, me beside her and Sky too. Your Mama paid for her to have a pine box. They put her in the slave burial ground on Pitt Street. Mrs. Letgoodis carried me and Sky over there in the carriage to see her resting place and say goodbye. Sky has turned 22 now and stands tall as a man. When we stood by the grave, I didn't come up to her shoulder. She sang the song the women on the plantation sing when they pound rice to leave on the graves. She said they put rice there to help the dead find their way back to Africa. Sky had a pocketful from the kitchen house, and she spread it over Mama while she sang. What came to me was the old song I made up when I was a girl. Cross the water, cross the sea, let them fishes carry me home. I sang that. Then I took the brass thimble, the one I loved from the time I was little, and I left it on top of her grave so she'd have that part of me. Well, I wanted you to know. I guess she's at peace now. I hope this letter makes it to you. If you write me, take care, because your sister Mary watches everything. The black driver from her plantation named Hector is the butler now, and he does her spying. Your friend, Handful. I wrote Sarah's name and address on the front by the light of the candle, copying Mrs. Handwriting as close as I could manage. Mrs. Penship had fallen off so bad I could have set down any kind of lettering and passed it off for hers. I closed the letter with a drop of wax and pressed it with Mrs. Seal's stamp. I'd stole the stamp from her room. Let's say borrowed it. I planned to take it back before it was missed. The stationery, though, was just plain stolen. Across the room, Sky was sleeping, thrashing in the heat. I watched her arms, searched the spot on the mattress where Mama used to lay, then I blew out the flame and watched the smoke tail away in the dark. Tomorrow I'd slip the letter in the batch going to the post and hope nobody took a hard look. Sky sang out in her sleep, sounded like Gullah, and I thought of the rice she'd sprinkle on Mama's grave trying to send her spirit to Africa. Africa. Wherever me and Sky were, that's the only place Mama would be.
Sarah. I woke each day to a sick, empty feeling. Catherine had given us until the first day of October to pack our things and leave, but we could find no one who'd take in two sisters expelled by the Quakers, and Lucretia's house was packed with children now. The streets had been flooded with hand flyers. They were tacked on light posts and buildings and strewn on the ground, the headlines screaming out in the salacious way these street rags did. Outrage! An abolitionist of the most revolting character is among you. Below that, Nina's letter to the Liberator was printed in full. Even the lowliest boarding houses wouldn't open their doors to us. I'd reached the borders of despair when a letter came with no return name or address on the envelope. 29 September, 1835. Dear Mrs. Grimke, if you are bold enough to sit with us on the Negro pew, perhaps you will find it in yourself to share our home until you find more suitable lodging. My mother and I have nothing to offer but a partially furnished attic, but it has a window, and the chimney runs through the middle of it and keeps it warm. It is yours if you would have it. We ask that you not speak of the arrangement to anyone, including your present landlord, Catherine Morris. We await you at 5 Lancaster Row. Yours in fellowship, Sarah Mapps Douglas. We departed our old life the next day, leaving no forwarding address and no goodbye, arriving by coach at a tiny brick house in a poor, mostly white neighborhood. There was a crooked wooden fence around the front with a chain on the gate, which necessitated us dragging our trunks to the back door. The attic was poorly lit and gauzy with cobwebs, and when a fire blazed below, the room filled with stultifying heat and smelled bitter with wood smoke. But we didn't complain. We had a roof. We had each other. We had friends in Sarah Mapps and Grace. Sarah Mapps was well educated, perhaps more than I, having attended the best Quaker academy for free blacks in the city. She would tell me that even as a child she'd known her only mission in life was to found a school for black children. "Few understand that kind of emphatic knowing," she said. "Most people, including my mother, feel I've sacrificed too much by not marrying and having children. But the pupils, they are my children." I understood far better than she realized. Like me, she loved books, keeping her precious volumes inside a chest in their small front sitting room. Each evening she read to her mother in her lovely sing-song voice, Milton, Byron, Austin, continuing long after Grace had fallen asleep in her chair. There were hats everywhere in various stages of construction, hanging on tree racks throughout the house, and if not actual hats, then sketches of hats scattered on tables and wedged into the frame of the mirror by the door. Grace made big, wild-feathered creations, which she sold to the shops. Creations that, as a Quaker, she never could have worn herself. Nina said she was living vicariously, but I think she simply possessed the urgings of an artist. Our first week in the attic, we cleaned. We swept out the dust and spiders and shined the window glass. We polished the two narrow bed frames, the table and chair, and the creaky rocker. Sarah Mapps brought up a hand-braided rug, bright quilts, an extra table, a lantern, and a small bookshelf where we set our books and journals. We tucked evergreen boughs under the eaves to scent the air, and hung our clothes on wall hooks. I placed my pewter inkstand on the extra table. By the second week, we were bored. Sarah Mapps had said we should be careful to conceal our comings and goings, that the neighbors would not tolerate racial mixing. But slipping out one day, we were spotted by a group of ruffian boys who pelted us with pebbles and slurs.
Amalgamators! Amalgamators!
The next day, the front of the house was egged. The third week, we became hermits. When November arrived, I began to pace the oval rug as I reread books and old letters, holding them as I walked, trying not to disappear into the melancholic place I'd visited since childhood. I felt as if I was fighting to hold my ground, that if I stepped off the rug, I would fall into my old abyss. Before we'd left Catherine's, a letter had arrived from Handful telling us of Charlotte's death. Every time I read it, so many times Nina had threatened to hide it from me, I thought of the promise I'd made to help Handful get free. It had plagued me my whole life, and now that Charlotte was gone, instead of releasing me, her death had somehow made the obligation more binding. I told myself I had tried. I had tried. How many times had I written Mother begging to purchase Handful in order to free her? She'd not even acknowledged my requests. Then one morning, while my sister used the last of our paints to capture the bare willow outside the window, and I walked my trenchant path on the rug, I suddenly stopped and gazed at the pewter inkstand. I stared at it for whole minutes. Everything was in shambles, and there was the inkstand.
Nina! Do you remember how Mother would make us sit for hours and write apologies? Well, I'm going to write one. A true apology for the anti-slavery cause. You could write too. We both could.
She stared at me, while everything I felt and knew offered itself up at once.
It's the South that must be reached, I said. We're Southerners. We know the slaveholders, you and I. We can speak to them. Not lecture them, but appeal to them.
Turning toward the window, she seemed to study the willow, and when she looked back, I saw the glint in her eyes.
We could write a pamphlet.
She rose, stepping into the quadrangle of light that lay on the floor from the window.
Mr. Garrison printed my letter. Perhaps he would print our pamphlet, too, and send it to all the cities in the South. But let's not address it to the slaveholders. They'll never listen to us.
Who then?
We'll write to the Southern clergy, and to the women. We'll set the preachers upon them, and their wives, and mothers, and daughters.
I wrote in bed on my lap desk, wrapped in a woolen shawl, while Nina bent over the small table in her old fur-lined bonnet. The entire attic ached with cold, and the scratch-scratch of our pens, and the whippoorwills already calling to each other in the gathering dark. All winter the chimney had steeped the attic with heat, and Nina would throw open the window to let in the icy air. We wrote sweltering, or we wrote shivering, but rarely in between. Our pamphlets were nearly finished. Mine, an epistle to the clergy of the Southern states, and Nina's, an appeal to the Christian women of the South. She'd taken the women, and I the clergy, which I found ironic, considering I'd done so poorly with men and she so well. She insisted it would have been more ironic the other way around, her writing about God when she'd done so poorly with him. We'd set down every argument the South made for slavery and refuted them all. I didn't stutter on the page. It was an ecstasy to write without hesitation, to write everything hidden inside of me, to write with the sort of audacity I wouldn't have found in person. I sometimes thought of Father as I wrote, and the brutal confession he'd made at the end.
Do you think I don't abhor slavery? Do you think I don't know it was greed that kept me from following my conscience?
But it was mostly Charlotte who haunted my pages. Below us in the kitchen, I heard Sarah Mapps and Grace feeding wood into the stove, an ornery old Rumford that coughed up clouds of smut. Soon we smelled vegetables boiling, onions, parsnips, beet tops, and we gathered our day's work and descended the ladder. Sarah Mapps turned from the stove as we entered, sheaves of smoke floating about her head.
"Do you have new pages for us?"
she asked, and her mother, who was pounding dough, stopped to hear our answer. "Sarah has brought down the last of hers," Nina said. "She wrote the final sentence today, and I expect to complete mine tomorrow." Sarah Mapps clapped her hands the way she might have done for the children in her class. Our habit was to gather in the sitting room after the meal, where Nina and I read our latest passages aloud to them. Grace sometimes grew so distressed at our eyewitness accounts of slavery, she would interrupt us with all sorts of outbursts.
"Such an abomination! Can't they see we are persons? There but for the grace of God."
Finally, Sarah Mapps would fetch the millinery basket so her mother could distract herself by jabbing a needle into one of the hats she was making.
"A letter came for you today, Nina,"
Grace said, wiping dough from her hands and digging it from her apron. Few people knew of our whereabouts. Mother and Thomas in Charleston, and I'd sent the address to Handful as well, though I'd not heard back from her. Among the Quakers, we'd informed no one but Lucretia, afraid that Sarah Mapps and Grace would suffer for consorting with us. The handwriting on the letter, however, belonged to none of them. I gazed over Nina's shoulder as she tore open the letter.
"It's from Mr. Garrison," Nina cried.
I'd forgotten. Nina had written him some weeks ago, describing our literary undertaking, and he'd responded with enthusiasm, asking us to submit our work when it was finished. I couldn't imagine what he might want.
21 March, 1836. Dear Miss Grimke, I have enclosed a letter to you from Elijah White in New York. Not knowing how to reach you, he entrusted the letter to me to forward. I think you will find it of utmost importance. I pray the monographs you and your sister are writing will reach me soon, and that you will both rise to the moment that is now upon you. God grant you courage. William Lloyd Garrison.
Nina looked up, her eyes searching mine, and they were filled with a kind of wonder. With a deep breath, she read the accompanying letter aloud.
2 March, 1836. Dear Miss Grimke, I write on behalf of the American Anti-Slavery Society, which is soon to commission and send forth 40 abolition agents to speak at gatherings across the free states, winning converts to our cause and rousing support. After reading your eloquent letter to the Liberator and observing the outcry and awe it has elicited, the Executive Committee is unanimous in its belief that your insight into the evils of slavery in the South and your impassioned voice will be an invaluable asset. We invite you to join us in this great moral endeavor, and your sister Sarah as well, as we have learned of her sacrifice and staunch abolitionist views. We believe you may be more amenable to the mission if she accompanies you. If the two of you would consent to be our only female agents, we would have you speak to women in private parlors in New York. We would expect you the 16th of next September for 2 months of rigorous agent training under the direction of Theodore Weld, the great abolitionist orator, Your circuit of lectures will commence in December. We ask for your prayerful deliberation and your reply. Yours most sincerely, Elijah White, Secretary, AASS. The four of us stared at one another for a moment with blank, astonished expressions, and then Nina threw her